You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
This episode of Social Europe Podcast is brought to you by the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford. The Oxford Executive MBA enables current and future business leaders to make a difference in their chosen field. The part-time program is designed to fit alongside your work commitments and offers you a global network. Visit the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford website for further details. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Social Europe Podcast, episode 38. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. It's great that you're interested in our podcast, but you might also find our regular articles, blogs, and other written publications of interest. Just visit our website at www.socialeurope.eu to read our latest output. If you want to stay up to date with all things Social Europe, just sign up to our regular newsletter. You can do so on our website. Now, without further ado, here's Social Europe Podcast, episode 38. My conversation partner today is Cass Sunstein, who is currently the Robert Walmsley University Professor at Harvard University. From 2009 to 2012, he was administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. He's also the founder and director of the Program on Behavioral Economics and Public Policy at Harvard Law School. Great. Cass Sunstein, thank you very much for being on Social Europe Podcast with me today. And, you know, we try to establish information and provide information that should inform policymaking and good policymaking. And most people will probably be familiar with your work on nudging and, the latest work by Princeton University Press on freedom. But for the few people out there who might not know about your previous work, could we start off by maybe exploring, again, just briefly, the differences between policies, economic incentives, and nudges? So what are the differences and what makes each special?
Okay, great. So I worked in the White House under President Obama for 4 years, so I had a concrete sense of the differences. So a nudge might be something like a calorie label, which tells you the caloric content of your cheeseburger, or a nudge might be something like a warning that would accompany medicines that you shouldn't take three pills, you should take one pill. Or a nudge may take the form of something like an automatic enrollment in a program. So you're automatically in a savings program, or you're automatically in green energy, something that many German companies I know have been interested in. An incentive, by contrast, could take the form of a subsidy. Should say, if you buy an electric car, we'll give you some money to make it worth your while. Or it could be a tax, as in a cigarette tax or a tax on fuel use. Those would be very different kinds of instruments. Or there could be something like a prohibition or a mandate, which would say, for example, you're not allowed to buy refrigerators that don't have a certain level of energy efficiency, or you're forbidden to use certain kinds of medicines at all. Maybe you can use them with a doctor's prescription, but maybe some are just unlawful because they're not going to help you. They're going to make you sick. The advantage of nudges as a policy intervention, and I saw this up close in the United States, and Germany has certainly used a lot of these approaches, is they maintain freedom of choice. So if you give people information, if you give them a warning, if you give them a reminder, they can say, okay, I'm informed, but I still want to eat a cheeseburger or some milk chocolate. Or they might say, I've been warned that I shouldn't go swimming because the waves are going to be high today, but I'm a pretty strong swimmer and I'm going to feel confident that it's going to be okay. So freedom of choice is preserved through nudges, and that's a point in their favor.
And before we go into the question of freedom of choice, you probably have a very good overview. I mean, I only moved back to Germany in the middle of last year as a kind of Brexit refugee. But before that, I lived for 15 years in the UK, in London. And number 10 had a nudge unit, at least at some point. And also, as you rightly say, some other governments had a very big interest in nudges. So what have you seen? How has that work that you and Richard Thaler have done influenced policymaking across the world? Where did you see particularly good examples? Where did you see examples you can improve upon? So what has the actual implementation of nudging been in government?
Okay, so I think one of the world leaders, and certainly the one I know the best, is my own government. And under President Obama, we have a fuel economy label. So when people buy automobiles, they get great clarity about the economic consequences of having cars that are very fuel efficient, meaning you're going to save money. And it also gives you some information about the environmental impacts, and that's a nudge, and it was certainly informed by what's out there in terms of behavioral economics and behavioral science. We also, in order to protect consumers, credit card users, have a credit card law, which gives people a lot of information about the, in very simple form, but a lot of information about the consequences if they don't pay on time or if they go over the limit. And we have some restrictions on the amount that can be charged for over the limit fees. These are all behaviorally informed by knowledge of how consumers may not be attentive to certain things. Our Federal Communications Commission, and this is something I worked on, something where if people are going to go over their fee limit for a cell phone use, they have to be reminded in advance. And the credit card law is actually saving consumers the equivalent of billions of euros in credit card fees annually. For helping children, this is something else from my country, who are eligible for free school meals, but their parents don't sign them up. We had a behaviorally informed nudge, which is they're automatically enrolled. So if we know they're eligible, they're automatically in. They don't have to stay in if for some reason the parents don't want them in the program. The consequence is that in a bad year, eight, meaning not as many as the usual, 8 or 9 million children are enjoying meals to which they have a legal right. As you say, the United Kingdom has had spectacular success. First, it was in 10 Downing Street. I was there very, very recently, just a few days ago. Now they have an even larger enterprise than they had then, and it works closely with the government on things involving organ donations, how to increase organ donations, how to decrease tax delinquency. They've had great success there. Measures to increase the likelihood that doctors will not overprescribe antibiotics. So more simple way to say it is to decrease over prescription of antibiotics. They've had great success. They're now operating in 31 countries, and they've had either significant successes increasing healthy behavior by 1 or 2 points or percentage points or decreasing it by 3 or 4 percentage points. And in some cases, they've had massive successes involving economic savings or savings and in people's lives. There are now behavioral groups, which are sometimes called nudge units, which are up and running in many countries. I'm recently back from the Netherlands, which is one of the world leaders, and Ireland. I'm married to an Irish woman, so I have special loyalty to Ireland. Ireland is one of the world's leaders. Germany has done some superb work, both by people who are behaviorally informed and are using scientific information to see what would help consumers. Former Attorney General Heiko Maas, who's now the foreign minister, has been keenly interested in these issues, interested in protecting consumers in this way. In France, there's keen interest, and a great deal has been done. Notably, in the Middle East, in Qatar and Lebanon, there's growing interest. Japan and Singapore have active nudge units, and it is a worldwide phenomenon.
Very good. And I mean, I first came across it when I did an MSc in finance years ago. So I've been a keen reader and follower of nudging, because I've been, as I said, very interested in this. But if you look at the policy mechanisms, what on top of, say, change your default enrollment options, for instance, being automatically enrolled in pension systems and then having an opt-out on automatically enrolled in other schemes, and providing certain information at key points, what other mechanisms for policymaking are there that would fall under nudging?
So President Obama issued an executive order, which is fully enforced under President Trump, with the charming name Executive Order 15263, I think it is. I may have the number wrong, but it's the executive order on regulatory policy. And what it does is it lists default rules, it lists warnings, it lists a provision of information, and which would be government-provided information and mandatory disclosure. So that those are probably among the primary tools. In the United Kingdom and in some other countries, there's been an emphasis on telling people about social norms. So if you tell people the social norm in your community, and this is something that's worked in the United Kingdom, is to pay your taxes, and you're in a small minority of people who aren't, that significantly has increased compliance. And one way to reduce excessive opioid prescriptions and excessive prescriptions of antibiotics is to tell the doctors who are in the top percentile, just that they're in the top percentile, and that has worked. So disclosure of social norms is a way. One way to encourage healthy eating is to have stores put the healthy foods in prominent places and to have the less healthy offerings in less prominent places. Now, I'd be very careful about having the government mandate anything like that. You want the private sector to be making those choices. But companies all over the world, including grocery stores and supermarket chains, have been very alert to this as a way of encouraging people to make healthier choices. You can have order effects on a website. So if the goal is to encourage people, let's say, to choose one plan, it may involve healthcare, it may involve anything financial, to have the clarity and a big font, the one that's salient to the mind, is the one that's out there. And it seems small, but it can have a massive effect in nudging people to choose one or another option. Now, you want to be very careful that you're nudging people in a way that is transparent and not hidden, and that it is that's reality checked, so it fits with people's interests, but it can have a big impact. There's interest in many places in the world now about in tourism and reducing the stress that tourism can place on environmental amenities, and that consumers can be nudged through just information. That's the one in the Obama executive order. The broadest concept, which will kind of be the simplest answer to your question, is choice architecture. So any situation in which we're making a choice has an architecture behind it, and things that alter the architecture, it might be simplification, it might be removal of obstacles, can count as a nudge. So one policy that some countries have adopted is to reduce the extent of trouble the travelers have to go through when they come back from other countries or when they go through security within their country. And that can be a simplification, which can be a nudge to ease not a horrible problem, but a significant inconvenience that people would otherwise face.
Yeah, before we get to the issue of freedom, I mean, you already mentioned what some private sector actors are doing in the field. So my follow-up question would be, what do companies do? What do maybe NGOs do in terms of nudging? I mean, one of the key aspects that you already mentioned in terms of choice architecture, if you're in a supermarket, put the fruit at the checkout and not the candy bars. So because that is the impulse buy, where the impulse buy takes place. And, you know, you would tend to buy then a fruit and veg rather than some sweets. So what else have been, in your view, very successful nudges in adopted by either companies or some actors in the private sector or even NGOs?
So if you're a company, let's say, and you want to sell a product that's healthier, there's a challenge to make it maximally attractive to consumers. And I'll just give you two examples from a soft drink company, Pepsi, which in Europe has done extremely well with Pepsi Max, better, it appears, than it did with Diet Pepsi. Pepsi Max is behaviorally very intelligent because it suggests maximum flavor rather than it's not going to taste very good, but it's going to have fewer calories. So the idea of Max makes people think full taste, and I think it's a good drink, so fair enough, full taste, plus it's not going to be as fattening as if you had regular Pepsi. So that Pepsi Max is behaviorally smart. Pepsi has also produced a product called Hello Goodness, which is a vending machine which has healthier choices. And the Hello Goodness brand has been a way of catering to some extent to a antecedent consumer desire to get things that are a bit healthier, but also promoted the sense that healthy things are goodness, where goodness can be thought of as delicious, but also better for you. Financial institutions have done things that are intended to bank the unbanked. That is to make it easier for people who don't have a lot of money to have some kind of banking account. And I've worked a little bit on this issue, both in government without with financial institutions, because if you're poor, if you have a bank account, you're going to be a lot better off. So to nudge people to have what might be very inexpensive bank accounts, just so they have a place where they can put their money, that's an example. Facebook is not the most popular company in the world right now. I think that's a safe statement to make. But they've taken some good steps with respect to their news feed to reduce the risk that people will end up in echo chambers. The news feed is less focused on algorithming you into an information cocoon. And, you know, you can see what information sources you want. No company in a free society can prevent you from doing that. But what you see on your Facebook page is a product of the choice architecture chosen by Facebook, and it is a few steps removed from something which would make sure you're just seeing the sorts of things that fit with your current political convictions.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the early criticisms, if I remember correctly, of nudging or liberal paternalism was that is it actually obvious what the right choice be and nudge people in a certain direction? And I read your most recent book on freedom as basically a very comprehensive way to address this kind of criticism. And I mean, you already mentioned the key feature that you keep choice. Right. So the individual is still free to opt out or to do something else. But, you know, you set the parameters differently by sort of being conscious about the choice architecture that you apply. And I thought a very interesting point where the sort of philosophical roots of freedom are very limited when you started in this book is you have nudges, you're subject to nudges, whether you like it or realize it or not. So the question is really to nudge or not to nudge, but the question is, you know, do you use it for something that is thought through, or are you just subject to nudges that are implemented not just by governments, but also private actors through marketing to certain, you already mentioned one of the campaigns for Pepsi, Pepsi Max, so you're necessarily subject to it. And then you go on to basically sketch out three key areas where you need to be a bit more differentiated when you talk about navigability, self-control, and happy, you know, with whatever outcome it is. So maybe you could dwell a bit on this kind of situation that you are being nudged, whether you like it or not, and what sort of these distinctions are.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. So the concern that, you know, you might be nudged by some person who doesn't have your interests at heart and is either self-interested or not competent or something bad, that's completely fair. As you said, it's not a strong objection to nudging, because you're going to be nudged just because you live in a world that has choice architecture. So if there's a website, it's going to nudge you, even if the designer of the website didn't think very much about that. If you go into a grocery store, it's full of nudges, and the grocery store probably did do some thinking. But even if it said, we're not going to nudge, that's our philosophy, good luck with that. A political platform will have nudges in it, and a policy involving Social Security or criminal justice or healthcare, inevitably that's going to have nudges in it just by virtue of how the options are presented. If you go to a doctor or if you go to a lawyer, and that's what I am, they're going to nudge you even if they're determined not to. They can act in a way that maximizes your autonomy, and that may well be an excellent idea. But even if that's what they're determined to do, they're creating a choice architecture that will nudge you, perhaps in ways that you don't exactly love. So the anti-nudge program, let's call it, is a little like complaining about air or water, meaning can't have human life without those things. You could try to minimize the number of nudges. So you might think that, okay, it's true. In a lot of areas, we are inevitably going to nudge. But we might or might not adopt a campaign against drunk driving. We may or may not adopt a nudge effort to reduce distracted driving. There are some things that are optional. And there it's fair to ask, is it a good thing to proceed with the nudge effort? And then we need to know what it is to know if it's a good thing to proceed with. Okay, the reason for this particular book, which is a short book, is that there's one idea that seems to me increasingly kind of central to life, which has been sadly neglected both by my heroes in political philosophy. Jürgen Habermas is one of the great theorists of self-government and liberty, and John Stuart Mill is one of my other heroes. And in philosophy, what I'm about to describe has been neglected. In economics, which ought to focus on this, we're not seeing a whole lot. In political science, almost nothing. In psychology, only a little bit. In my own field, law, essentially nothing. And that gap, let's call it to be a little more grandiose than it deserves, the great gap in the Western tradition of thinking about freedom is the problem of navigability. And the word has too many syllables. I hope in other languages there are better words. It's not a very user-friendly word. More syllables, but kind of have a precision and elegance, which the English word lacks. So navigability means you might have freedom of choice, but you don't know how to get from one place to another. In the financial sector, people might want to have investments for the next decade or for their retirement, but they might have no idea how to do it, or they might not have no idea how to do it well. And that can be an extremely serious problem. It can mean they'll end up with in money market fund, and they won't end up with anything really, or they might not save, they might not enroll in a savings program, they're just not sure how. So that's on the economic side. People may have a health problem. They may be suffering from diabetes or from some sort of heart disease, and they might not, it might be early stages, and they might not know what to do. And what a well-functioning healthcare system does is to provide people with a kind of map. It's a little like a GPS device. Now, this might seem in the healthcare area more a metaphor than something that has, serious anything in it. But I'm going to give an issue where the seriousness, I think, is we're talking about a widespread social problem where we've made far too little progress, and it's the problem of mental health, where people all over the world are suffering from depression or anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder. And these are, in the vast majority of cases, treatable conditions. But people don't know how to get from here, which may be a terrible struggle, to there, which might be a really good life. And to see this as a freedom issue is really important, because people who suffer from mental illness often consider themselves trapped. It's as if they're in some kind of prison. And to tell them you have freedom of choice, is important and true, but not enough. They have to solve the navigation problem. And a private sector that's working well can provide that solution. A government that's working well can do it. But even in the wealthiest countries, that particular navigation problem isn't sufficiently solved. So that, if we could make progress on that in the next 10 years, we could do a great deal for the benefit of humanity. It would be one of the great achievements in the century, really. You do make a nice set of distinctions, which I try to work with in the book, where often people have a very simple navigability challenge. They may want to lose weight and they're not sure how. They might want to save some money and they need someone who helps them. or they may want to get a job, but the location and nature of the job is just a mystery to them. And in these cases, a nudge which can provide them with the solution, the equivalent of the GPS device, is freedom promoting, and I think presents no conceptual challenge. It presents just a implementation challenge. How do we do it? And I know there are people, I've been in Berlin and worked with some officials there who are very much focused on this question with respect to issues that even in a wealthy and well-functioning country, issues that are quite serious. It might involve what to do about immigrants. Take bracket even the most serious and politically divisive question. To the extent that there are immigrants there who are facing real challenges, they want something that would be in the national interest to get, maybe employment or maybe language help. And how do we do that? So there's a cost issue, but the theoretical issue isn't so hard. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is self-control problems, where in the most serious cases, people might suffer from an addiction to, they may be alcoholics, they may be smokers, they may have some drug issue. And there, the work on what it's like to be an addict really puts the question of freedom in big, bold letters, where Kant, in some ways the greatest thinker on freedom that the Western tradition has ever had, didn't focus on this, that if you have a self-control problem, it's all very well to say that you can go your own way. And it's true in some legal sense. But if you are an alcoholic, you need some way to overcome the trap in which you find yourself, which is you can't stop drinking. And this is an intensely important practical problem, but it's also a serious theoretical issue, I think. Philosophers, including Aristotle, have thought a lot about weakness of will. We have a little more traction on that from behavioral economics, which explores how people are both doers and planners, and what they are as doers may not be the same as what they plan. And so there's a kind of two-self model, which is instructive. And we want to give more authority to the planner in these cases than to the doer. And there you can think of the solution to the addiction problem or a self-control problem, which might not be so extreme. It might involve spending. It might involve dating. Might involve bad romance, capital B, capital R. And it's not people aren't literally trapped, we should hope. And they aren't trapped in the same sense as an addict. But they need a solution to a navigation problem. And nudges can be extremely helpful there.
And I think what I found very convincing in your argument, below the level of straightforward addiction, is what you say, as judged by themselves, is not time consistent. So what your judgment at T1 is might not be your judgment at T2, and the judgment of T2 might be regretted at T3. And this example of this sort of work conference romance that you put in the book is a very instructive one. So even if you wanted to, the question is really as judged, or what is the preference at what given time, and what are the circumstances at the given time, and do you have a personal bias where, as we know, you tend to choose gratification now and postpone the costs into the future. So even below this addiction level, I thought that was very, very important, because these might be choices that a lot of people will regularly come across and might not be aware of this or think about it in such a structured manner.
Yeah, so the example that's probably will resonate at least as a imaginative exercise in many people's minds, and for some people more than imaginative exercise, where you're, let's say happily involved with a spouse or a partner, then you go to a conference and there's someone you really like and there's an opportunity. Before the conference, you would have thought, I definitely don't want a romance. That would be very damaging and morally doubtful. But then you meet someone, you quite like her, let's suppose, and she kind of likes you, and something happens, and that's what you want at time two. And at time three, in the majority of cases, I think, though I haven't done empirical study, people think, why did I do that? There's a terrible regret, and there's a life upheaval there that's been created. So at time two, people have done something that creates a serious problem by the standpoint of what they were thinking at time one and time three. So this, as you say, it's the time inconsistency problem. I think in most cases of that kind, the best approach is to nudge people against impulsivity and recklessness at time two. Now, in a case like this, social norms and friends are probably more important or more appropriate than government. But we can think of cases involving consumption behavior or savings behavior or health risks, which have the same structure as the, let's say, workplace conference romance case.
I mean, one of the things I could think of, you know, on the top of my head is pension savings, right? So is a typical one. You know that you should do it. You do too little, and later on, if you then have a significant fall of your income, and if you have a massive decline in your living standard, that's where the regret kicks in. But then it's too late. So I mean, they're probably. In everybody's lives, more examples of this than they care to admit, probably.
Completely. And these cases we're now discussing, they aren't the simple navigation problem where people think at time one, help me get where I want to go. And at time two, they've found the destination and they're very glad. These are cases that are more complicated. They are cases, the savings one, I think, in particular, where if a private institution or the government can help make sure people aren't going to be really struggling in old age, that's a blessing. And the idea of automatic enrollment in pension plans, which in Denmark and the United States and the United Kingdom, the data is extremely powerful, that automatic enrollment greatly increases participation rates. And if the default contribution rate is high enough, you're going to ensure that many millions of people are going to have what would otherwise be a terrible time. They're going to be pretty comfortable.
Mm-hmm. And if you end on the freedom issue about, you know, the chapter that you called Happy Either Way, so which is the third sort of permutation of freedom. What do you mean by this in particular?
These are the hardest cases. So suppose you have someone, we'll start mundane, someone who is enrolled in an energy plan, and it's not the cleanest energy, it's coal. And let's suppose they don't switch because green would be a little more expensive. And they're pretty happy. They would like to be green if it weren't more expensive, but it's more expensive. So they're staying with coal. That's one person. Now imagine another person who's exactly the same, but who's served by a German company. I know there are a number of companies like this that automatically enrolls people in green energy, solar, let's say, or wind. It's a little more expensive, let's just assume. And they're asked, do you want to switch to coal? You can. It'll be a little cheaper. And they say, no, I don't want to be a bad person. I'm glad I'm enrolled in green energy. Now, the interesting feature of this problem is it can be exactly the same person who's happy with coal, if that's the automatic enrollment, or with green, if that's the automatic enrollment. They're happy either way. Then what do you do? Or you can have someone who, with respect to something large in their life, let's say, could be nudged, let's say, by a private institution or maybe the government to be more ambitious in their career and to take another path. And if they do, they're going to be just great. But if they don't, they're also going to be just great. They're going to, in the sense they'll be happy either way. And these are cases where the as judged by themselves standard is met, because we're stipulating people are going to think, I'm great. I'm glad I'm in green energy. I'm glad I took that path. But they would have been happy the other way too, as judged by themselves. So the as judged by themselves criterion, which is meant as a check on, let's call it bad nudging. It still is a check, but it doesn't tell you what to do because they'd be happy either way. And the number of cases where human beings are such that if they go through one door, they're going to be just fine, or if they go through a different door, they're going to be just fine. It's not infinite, but it's very large, that we can be happy because we'll adapt to where we find ourselves. And that makes it challenging in those cases for, let's say, a financial institution, for an employer, for an advisor, for a friend, or for government to decide which way to nudge. I have an idea, but it's a hard one.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's great that we sort of, duck into these three dimensions of freedom that you really have to think through at the same time, and that are not sort of part and parcel of the traditional way of thinking about freedom traditionally. Let me finish this this podcast episode on something more experimental. I also came across that, you know, in the middle of Baby Nudging and your most recent book on freedom, you wrote an interesting book called The World According to Star Wars. And it's interesting, read through it, is that you try to, you know, dig deeper into why some things flop and others didn't. And I was immediately taken because I also saw the movie Searching for Sugar Man about Rodriguez, who was, I think in Detroit it was, by his own imagination, an unsuccessful rock star who, unknown to himself, became a star in South Africa because somebody imported a few LPs at the time, and then it really took off. If we can try in a very experimental way, because we are sort of trying to improve policy making, is what would, you know, if you had ideas of sort of a good policy that in your judgment would sort of benefit society more broadly, so how could you popularize such a policy? I mean, do you have some sort of insights into that from your work on these phenomena? I mean, you were talking about initial bursts of information, informational cascades, reputational cascades. Is there any lesson to be learned for, you know, how to popularize policies?
Sure. So in the domain of environmental policy, the idea of economic incentives has benefited from a cascade. So in the 1970s, if there was an environmental risk, the idea was regulate. The idea of an economic incentive through, let's say, a carbon tax or a pollution tax of some kind, it hasn't gone, you know, universal by any means, but it's a little like Rodriguez in South Africa. I'll give you a more current example, which I confess I'm amazed by, which is what we started, that the idea of nudge units in government, that is a little like Rodriguez in South Africa. That is, it benefited from some early LPs. The principal sales early on were in the United Kingdom, but they did very well because of the great creativity of the people there, and they delivered some real results. And now we have dozens of mostly successful nudge units. Transparency and open government is another example of a kind of cascade where there's now an open government partnership, OGP it's called. It's relatively recently. It has its own website. Signatory nations, and I think there are over 50, there may be well over 50 now, produce national action plans with some frequency, which have real commitments. And I wouldn't say that 100% of the commitments have been followed, but well over, you know, 25%, probably over 70% of the commitments have been followed. And that's like a successful rock star, the Open Government Partnership.
And then in terms of the actual policies, I mean, obviously we have the ideas that, you know, you become, if ideas, political ideas become cultural phenomena. I mean, if you look at the Fridays for Future, that is effectively becoming a cultural phenomenon amongst young people with a very political content. Sort of, would some of these sort of mechanisms fall also into this bracket?
Yes, I'm naturally drawn, just from my own experience, to government policies. So automatic enrollment in savings plans has become a very thinkable idea. Increasingly, we're seeing automatic enrollment in green energy being a thinkable idea. And these are things that governments do. The idea of something culturally resonating, that's deeper than a policy, and certainly we're observing it. I'll tell you a little story about the United States Constitution, which attests to what you're saying. which is the idea whether the U.S. Constitution should have a Bill of Rights. There was a strong disagreement about that. James Madison originally thought not, and he was the most important figure. He changed his mind, and he said, the reason is not that I'm going to trust the courts. The reason is I think once we have a Bill of Rights, it's going to seep into the culture. And the idea of freedom of speech and freedom of religion and due process of law, those will become cultural commitments. People will be committed to them in their hearts. And his view that that's more important than anything. And whether he succeeded completely, he succeeded in part.
Yeah, well, I was just drawn to the idea, you know, what can we learn for policy from Star Wars and looking at some of these cultural phenomena. So, but this is I think, an area where a lot of future research could also be conducted, because it seems to me that, you know, from a policy level, you want it to become a cultural entrenched, so that you permanently change behavior on a very deep level, which is below the policy surface.
The Star Wars success is partly because it's great, but part of the success, as with the success of, you know, your favorite singer, is that people started to think it was great, and then people started to hear other people thinking it was great, and then you seemed kind of foolish or ignorant if you didn't know about it or if you didn't think it was great. And by that point, we could have, you know, a worldwide phenomenon. And that, what happened to Star Wars, what interested me enough to get me writing this very improbable book, is that it works for ideas also, small ones maybe, sometimes, like, you know, should have an iPhone. That's a little like a more recent version of Star Wars, but also large ideas, like ideas about, you know, the appropriate approach to ozone depletion, where the world agreed to the Montreal Protocol in a way that would have seemed extremely improbable even 3 years before the world went that way.
Yeah. And as we see, unfortunately, in many polities at the moment, it all can also work the other way. Yeah. So, but Cass Sunstein, thank you very much for taking the time today to speak with me about, you know, nudging and, you know, how it relates to freedom. And I'm sure, you know, we'll follow this work further. And it's important for policymakers to understand this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.